So Alexander is about 19 years old. His father remarries, takes a second wife, and now his future is in doubt. Okay, and he kind of fights back. And there's this event, some party, where the new wife's family begins to kind of taunt Alexander. And as legend has it, they're saying that now Philip, you'll have a true heir, a real heir. And he takes offense to it and kind of throws like a goblet at him and tries to hurt him, and ends up that Alexander and his mother get exiled. Okay, so at the age of 19, he and his mother are exiled to like a remote island. And for all intents and purposes, it seems like he's out of the picture. Okay, so by the age of 19, it seems like he's going to be irrelevant. The biggest break Alexander ever gets is that a year later, his father is murdered, assassinated. The biggest break he ever got in his life. Seriously. You know, if his father lived another 30 years, we probably would never have heard of Alexander. He certainly would not be Alexander the Great. He'd be Alexander, not even a footnote in history. So it's funny sometimes how fate changes things. So his father's murdered, and now there is no heir, and now he's the heir, because he's 20 years old, 20, 21 years old, and now he's thrust into the role of king. Now, his dream had been to take over Persia. Now we have to get into Persia. So, as you remember from the Purim story, Persia was the ruler of the majority of the world, right? In the beginning of the Megillah, how does the Megillah describe the Persian Empire? And remember the language used? Mehodu viad Kush. Okay? Hodu viad Kush. What's Hodu?
Turkey.
Turkey. Okay? Hodu is Turkey.
Real Turkey or Turkey?
What? Turkey. Oh. Turkey to Kush, which is...
Ethiopia?
No, it's India.
I thought Kush was like Upper Egypt.
No, it's India. Turkey to Egypt is not a very big empire. Turkey to India is an empire. Okay? So, because then you're going north, and then somewhat northwest, and then east. So, you've got a vast majority of Asia, some Western Europe, and you've got Turkey and some of the Middle East. So, Persia still has this massive empire. They haven't really made their way into Europe per se. I mean, they're not into what's currently Germany, Italy, Greece. They don't go that far. But they go about up to Turkey. And that empire that's described in the Megillah is the empire that Persia still has as Alexander becomes king at around 335 BCE when he becomes king. I may be off by a year or two, but it's roughly 335 BCE. The king of Persia is now Darius III. Okay? The first Darius was who?
Darius the First.
Right, but who was he?
He was
Esther's son. Esther and Ahasuerus have a son whose name is Darius. And he's the one who allows for the rebuilding of the Second Temple. Now we're up to Darius the Third. So we're about 200 years after the rebuilding of the Second Temple.
Is he Jewish? Halachically, or we don't know?
Well...
Depends on who Darius the First married.
Right. I assume Darius the First did not marry a Jewish woman, so the Jewish line probably ends with her son. So, Darius the Third is now the ruler of... So here we are, a few hundred years after the Purim story, and really nothing has changed significantly in the world. Okay? So from Purim to Hanukkah, we're basically transitioning from world powers. We're transitioning from the world power of Persia to the world power of Greece. But when Alexander takes over, you know, Macedonia is not that significant of an empire. They have their space, they have their area, they have their philosophy, they have their gods, but they're not a major player in the world stage, right? They're somewhat significant. And when Alexander takes over as king, as often happens during that time, he is challenged very quickly. That all these different tribes and city states around Greece challenge the reign and want to be independent. They don't want to pay taxes and don't want to pay tribute to Alexander. And so pretty soon, he's got to figure out if he's ready to.
Just wanted to pay tribute. I got lost.
So all these different city states and all these different, you know, tribes in the within Greece and Macedonia don't necessarily want to be under the rule of this king. And now they've got this young, inexperienced king coming in. They want to pay them taxes. And so they're going to try to rebel and be independent. And if there's soldiers in their area, they want to kick him out. And so Alexander has to prove himself very quickly or lose a significant part of his whatever kingdom he has, which is not that significant. His father had done a very good job of building something for him to build on. So Philip had done that. But now, it was all very tenuous because they hadn't been around very long. Greece had lost the whole concept of city-states, and Athens and Sparta and all that had gone downhill, and there wasn't really a lot there when Philip took over. Philip kind of brought this together, created an army, created a concept of a nation, of an empire, and now Alexander takes over. But it's very new and it's very tenuous. And Alexander decides, we're going to fight this hard. And he goes in, any of these cities and city-states that try to rebel, he crushes them. Crushes them. Kills tens of thousands of people, enslaves the rest of the population, trying to send the message to anyone, you don't want to mess with me. Okay? He does that a couple times, right in the beginning of his reign, when he's about 21 years old. Alexander takes over, he's about 21 years old. So, he's establishing himself very quickly as being pretty ruthless. But what's interesting about Alexander is that in some ways he's very ruthless, in some ways he's very benevolent. We see his ruthlessness in the beginning, and then we see it again a little bit later on. But he has this vision of Greece being, you know, Greece taking over the world, right? And they viewed the Persians as being boorish, right? And if you read the Megillah, what's the perception you get of the Persians? They're not very impressive people.
They're not very cultivated.
Not very cultivated, not very cultured. You know, they're...
The king wants the wife to appear naked.
Yeah,
know,
right. There's not a lot to the culture. It doesn't seem like there's a lot to Persia that really is going to, you know, help humanity. So there's a certain part of Alexander, again, he's taught by Aristotle. He's a student. He grows up in the heart of this new culture of Greece, and he feels like the world would be a better place if Greece was the power and not Persia. Okay? However, he is in no place to do anything about it because Persia is giant and he's very small. But that doesn't stop him. And one thing you see about Alexander is he had unlimited ambition and really had no fear. Right? And he was famous for when they went to battle, he was in the front. Right, that was what he was famous for. Darius, when he would fight, Darius would be in the back, you know, leading the soldiers, but safely behind, you know, behind the troops. Alexander was in the front of the troops. He led them to battle. And so he earned instant respect from his troops because they saw he wasn't afraid. He wasn't hiding. And he was a very, you know, he was inspirational. He was able to take this kind of small but growing army and create a massive force. And he begins to make his way to Persia. And he makes his way east, and then he makes his way south. And first he goes all the way down to Egypt, going through Israel, which we'll get to in a second. So he does go through Israel. He definitely goes through Israel. And then he gets to Egypt, and he establishes the city of Alexandria, which there's a number of Alexandrias he founds around the world. And the cities of Alexandria are meant to be these new culture, you know, civilized cities, the beacons of light in their areas, right? So that's what all these Alexandrias. But the Alexandrian Egypt is seen as the main Alexandria, right on the coast of the Mediterranean. He comes back north to Turkey and decides he wants to take on Persia. He's outnumbered about 6-1. His troops are outnumbered about 6-1. He doesn't care. He's going to fight anyway. And he comes up with this whole strategy of how to defeat them, and his army defeats Persia, and he just keeps going and going and going. They go all the way to Kush. They go from Mehodu Viad Kush, Right? Alexander literally goes and takes over the entirety of the Persian Empire. From Turkey all the way to India. Through Afghanistan. They go through Afghanistan. He ends up all the way in India. And that's where they stop. And they stop because... the legend is they stop because his army can't go any further. They've been going for 8 years. They've been fighting battle after battle. They want to go home. They're done. So he wants to keep going. They stop there. But it's not so simple to go back. They didn't have airplanes. They had to then travel back from India all the way back to Greece. Alexander does not survive the trip. He gets sick. Some people want to say he was poisoned by his own men. I don't know. You know, a lot of theories. What?
I think he was wounded in one of the battles.
He died from illness. He didn't die from...
Maybe
an infection. Yeah, could be, no one knows exactly how he died. But he dies at the age of 33. 33 years old. Alexander is ready to go. So it's about 323 BC he dies. I think it's 323. So... he is probably the most successful army general of all time. He never lost a war. He didn't have a Waterloo. He didn't have some massive failure. And he dies young, and sometimes dying young helps maintain your reputation because it...
No chance to
lose it later in life. So, Alexander is a very... I'm bringing this all up first to get to what Greece is and how it starts. Okay. Because the story of Hanukkah takes place about 150 years after Alexander dies. So it's not really connected to Alexander per se, but there's a very interesting relationship between the Jewish people and Alexander. Now we're going to go through a passage in the Talmud that's a very interesting passage in the Talmud. But Greece, for the most part, is welcomed by into Israel, right? There's no war. There's a battle a little bit in Gaza, but Alexander goes through Israel without much trouble. The Jewish people don't really cause much of a fuss. They allow Greece to kind of maintain a presence in Israel, and in some ways they really embrace it. They view Alexander as being a hero, a savior of sorts, and he becomes almost a legend even in Judaism.
He's a savior because he repelled the Persians, or what?
So it's interesting. I mean, it's not like the Persians were such a problem for the Jews. They were doing their thing. The Persians, as we see from the Purim story, the leadership was not so concerned with world domination. They wanted money, they wanted wealth, but they weren't trying to impose very much on people, right? If anything, the Greeks imposed a lot more. But there was a sense that the Greeks were more civilized. There was a sense that the Greeks might be introducing something new to the world. And there was something about Alexander that made everyone stand up and notice and seemed to make everyone think that this person is special. And a part of Alexander's, from a very young age, is he thinks that he has divine purpose, right? You know, he's Zeus's son, people would say about him. He exhibited some qualities from a young age, but as he, you know, his personality, his skill set, the success that he had, he views himself as being divine in some ways. And we'll see that there's even some passages in Tanakh that allude to Alexander's arrival and conquering of Persia. So it seems that even then Israel, there already was a concept of accepting and embracing Alexander and the Greeks, because this was an inevitable part of world history. This is part of God's plan. And the Jews definitely felt that part of God's plan was that Alexander was part of God's plan for the world. Okay? In some broader sense. So he's embraced not just as another ruler that we have to embrace, otherwise they'll kill us, they'll wipe us out. There was this sense that Alexander was sent by God to do what he did. And that sense even the Jewish people had as well. So that's why Alexander becomes a Jewish name. Right? Alexander becomes a Jewish name. He's accepted to that level. There is no other precedent for that. No one else in Jewish history.
But wasn't there something about he was going to invade Jerusalem and had a vision of the
Holy So we'll get to that. But so he's accepted on a level that no other non-Jewish leader has ever been accepted. Now, there is an interesting allusion to Greece very early in the Torah. Okay? So, if you ever read through Parshat Noach, okay, at the end of Parshat Noach we get the lineage of the sons of Noach, and if you look at the names of their sons, it ends up being the names of the major nations of the world, right? So the names of Ham are Cush. Cush is India. Canaan, which is Canaan. Mitzrayim, which is Egypt. So we have all these names that are given, and these are like the founders of all these major areas. So this is what it says about this, about two of the sons, Yefet and Shem. The Torah says, this is in Parsha Noach, the 9th Perek and the 27th Pasuk. Yaft Elohim liYefet v'yishkom ba'ohel Shem. Okay, so may God extend Yafet, but he will dwell in the tents of Shem. So Shem is the son of Noach, who Avram descends from. So Shem, of the three sons of Noach, is the one where the Jewish people come from. And Yafet is the one where Greece comes from, where the Greek line comes from. So the way it's put here is that that God blesses Yafet as long as he dwells in the house of Shem. Okay, so Greece is welcome to even like partner with the Jewish people as long as it's within the realm of the Torah, right? Meaning as long as it's used as a means to an end, but not an end to itself, they're welcome to be part of the Jewish people. Okay? So that's how far back this goes. We're going back to Parsha Noach, there's already a reference to it. but there's even stronger references in the book of Daniel. So in the book of Daniel, I am now in the 7th chapter, the 4th pasuk. So here's what the verse says. Kadimata karaye vegapin din sharla khaze havet adi miritu gapa notila tmin arav ad raglin kanash hakimat ulvav enash yehivla. I saw my vision at night that behold the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Four immense beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched as its wings were plucked, and I was removed from the earth, and stood upon 2 feet like a man, and was given a human heart. And behold, another beast, the second one, similar to a bear. Okay, so, goes through all these different things. And, we have here, was that one more? And then behold, another beast, the second one, similar to a bear. It was placed on one side, and then there were three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And this is what they said to it: arise, devour much flesh. So what is this talking about? So the Abarbanel, so the bear represents the Persian Empire. Powerful and corpulent, but not speedy. It lacked the eagle's wings and the regal power of a lion. So the lion was Babylon, was Nebuchadnezzar. That was quick and that was fierce. The bear is Persia, which is this big empire, but doesn't really move, doesn't do very much, it just kind of sits there. Okay, and then six, the next pasuk, and this, after this I was watching, behold, another beast like a leopard, with four birds' wings on its back. The beast had four heads, and it was given dominion. So now we have the leopard, and the leopard is supposed to represent Alexander. Okay? The ferocious, impudent leopard represents the Greek Empire founded by Alexander, who conquered most of Asia in one continuous advance. Right, so it was fast, it was fierce, but moved really, really quickly. Within a few years, it conquered all of Persia, which was unheard of. The wings symbolize his speedy conquests in all four directions, and the foreheads allude to the four generals who divide the empire after Alexander's death, which we'll get to. And that's from the Abarbanel, but that's pretty much how it's seen. So Alexander shows up in Israel. So according to Josephus' account, the rabbis take out the book of Daniel and show him this and say, look, we were waiting for you. Right? We were waiting for you. This was Daniel's prophecy. This has been preordained by God that you will succeed. Okay? That you will conquer Persia. And Alexander is, you know, impressed by that. So that's Josephus' account. And one of the reasons why Alexander gives Israel a lot of religious freedom, doesn't really mess with them too much. He respects what they do. Alexander comes to Israel. He speaks to the rabbis. He goes to the temple. He offers a sacrifice. So the Talmud has an account of this as well. Let me read the Talmud's account. So, on the 25th day of Tevet is a day known as the day of Mount Gerizim, on which one is not permitted to eulogize. So they had this day, the 25th of Tevet, which one could not have eulogies because it was seen as a happy day. What was so happy about it? It is the day in which the Kuthians requested of Alexander the Macedonian permission regarding the house of our God, the temple, to destroy it. And he granted it to them. They, those who were apprised of his peril, came and informed Shimon HaTzadik of the decree. What did he do? He donned priestly vestments and wrapped his head in priestly vestments and set out to meet Alexander accompanied by some of the most prominent people in Israel. And there were lit torches in their hands and all night long. These were approaching from this side and those approaching from that side until the light of dawn rose. Once the light of dawn rose and Alexander saw a Jewish delegation in the distance, he said to them, who are these people? They answered him, it is the Jews who rebelled against you. As he reached Antipartes, the sun shone forth, and they, the two groups, met up with one another. As soon as Alexander saw Shimon HaTzadik, he alighted from his chariot and bowed down before him. The people that were with Alexander said to him, shall a great king like yourself bow down before this Jew? He replied to them, an image in the likeness of this man gains victory before me on all my battlefields. He then turned to the Jews and said, why have you come? They replied, Is it possible that with regard to the very house in which we pray for you and for your empire that it should not be destroyed, idolaters shall mislead you to destroy it. He said to them, who are these schemers who have misled me? He said to them, the Kuthians who stand before you. They buddied up to him. And he said, behold, they are given into your hands to punish them as you see fit. Skipping up a bit. Once they arrived at Mount Gerizim, okay, so they made that day a festive day because that day the temple was saved in their minds. So this is the Talmud's account of the rabbis meeting Alexander the Great when he comes to town. Like I said, Josephus has a slightly different account. His account is that Alexander says he has a dream. He had a dream when he was first starting his battles. And his dream was that this same person comes to him with a message from God telling him that he's going to conquer all of Asia, to conquer all of Persia, and to not be afraid, but to keep going, to start his battle right away. Okay. So anyway, there's these different references to Alexander being taken by the Jewish people, right? And that there was this divine connection between Alexander and God, Alexander and the Jewish people. And that relationship starts off very, very strong. Okay, any questions before we go forward?
Is he an idol worshiper?
Alexander?
Yeah.
He didn't view himself as an idol worshiper. That's a good question. He believed in the Greek gods. So, it's not quite idol worship in their sense. They viewed it as idol worship. They looked down at other forms of religion as being inferior and barbaric.
He thought himself divine, didn't he?
He thought himself divine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, for him to feel, well, he didn't think he was God, but he felt he had a divine message, a divine purpose, that he was sent by God.
It's nice to be a king.
Right, but it seems there's truth to it. Meaning, it's, you know, the way that we interpret the book of Daniel seems to imply that God does say in a prophecy to Daniel that there will be an Alexander who will overtake Persia. Alexander has these dreams. And he seems to be confident that this was from God. So he seems to have this sense that he's from God, and the Jewish people agreed with him.
And what told him it would be from the house of Yefet?
No, not necessarily. They didn't necessarily know, you know, when the prophecy happens, they don't necessarily know exactly who it's going to be, but as they see what's happening, they begin to think this is it. This is the prophecy.
Yeah. What was the benefit of him conquering all this stuff in relation to the Jews? Like, if the Jews thought he's got a mission that's kind of from God, and we're kind of behind him, and he's somewhat aligned, what did that actually do, though?
So, initially, not necessarily all that much. Right? Part of it might have been just thinking it's inevitable. Like I said, the Persians were not really trouble for the Jews. Mm. And if anything, the Persians had allowed and helped them build the second temple. And there's a history with Esther. So the Persians were not necessarily bad for Israel. And Greece could potentially be better, but not necessarily. So it wasn't that they were knew for sure that Greece would be better. Initially, Greece probably was even a little bit better. They might have felt that they were civilizing humanity, that they were, you know, more cultured. But there might have been just a certain sense of inevitability that, you know, not only we can stop it, so let's build a good relationship with Alexander now.
Because that big comes from Hashem.
Right. But this, yeah, so some, you know, so he just seems like he, you know, he's from Hashem. Mm. So this is the backstory. Now, after Alexander dies at such a young age, he does not have an heir. He did marry.
He did not have any children?
I don't believe he had any children. He married a princess in Afghanistan on his conquests and was planning on returning back to her and then eventually having children, but he died. He died on the way back. So he didn't. So he never has any children, I believe. If he did have a child, they would have been very, very young. But I don't think he had any children. He had his ruthlessness to him, and he was ruthless in some of his wars against Persia, very ruthless. You know, that second wife, who his father marries, Alexander kills her, and the baby that they have, because he doesn't want to. You know, anyone to be able to challenge his throne. So
in those times this happened.
This happened all the time. This was commonplace.
And that's very common.
Too. Yeah, for sure. That happened, you know, 200 years ago and 300 years ago.
What's going to happen to this North Korean guy?
One thing at a time. We don't have a holiday for him yet. So it's not that Alexander was some sort of perfect human being, but it does seem that he had this divine mission. Okay, so that brings us to the fallout. So the fallout is that that this massive empire has no heir, and that's not going to be clean, right? So they end up, there's fighting, there's wars, and they end up dividing up the empire into four different sections. We're only concerned with two. There's the Egypt, right? Egypt gets taken over by
Ptolemies.
I'm sorry?
Ptolemies.
Right, by Ptolemy, right?
P-T.
Yeah, let me see if the spelling right. The second one I'm definitely going to spell wrong, so let me get it before I spell it. Seleucid. How do you spell Seleucids?
Seleucid.
Here it is, okay.
L-U-C-I-D.
So it's Seleucus.
Yes.
Seleucid. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was okay. So, Ptolemy has Egypt, and Seleucus has
Syria.
Syria, right? We'll call it Syria, which includes Israel, which is what matters. And they're basically the four separate empires. And each one kind of acts independently for the most part. They have their own lineage, they have their own succession, they have their own monarchy, and they do a thing. There's wars between them. In the beginning, there's many wars. There's six Syrian wars, and they're battling for every inch, and you know, everyone's trying to, you know, fight for every little piece of land. But Israel is ruled by the Seleucids, and his descendants. In the year 175, Antiochus the IV takes command.
So is this BCE or?
This is what BCE. Okay. So 175 BCE, Antiochus the IV, which he calls himself Antiochus the Great. You know, why not? But actually, that was significant because there was a culture amongst these empires not to make yourself divine, not to make yourself to be the Holy Roman Emperor. You were just the emperor. But Antiochus begins to ascribe divine rights to his to himself.
They took on Greek culture, right?
Yeah, but that's the idea. It was divided amongst Alexander's generals who were Greek. So Ptolemy was not Egyptian, he was Greek. And he was just given this area, right? And they settled this area. So basically, four of his top generals and commanders, they each get a portion of this empire and rule it, and then they create their own empire within an empire. So Antiochus the IV is very ambitious and doesn't like to keep to his allotted section. And he begins to try to take over a larger area. He goes south and he goes north. He tries to take over Rome. He's repelled and his warrens stay away. But first he goes and takes over Egypt.
Rome is under Greek rule at that time?
Yeah. Everything was under Greek rule. Greek rule was Greece to India down to Egypt. But so basically, whatever Alexander conquers, they
Rome
still have.
Rome is west from there.
They have. Rome is.
Italy is west from
it. Well, it was Macedonia. Macedonia was more than just Greece. Macedonia went west and north as well. It was larger than just Greece. Greece was not the. Yeah. Macedonia was one area. Then there was the kind of the Asian area, and then there's this. So this empire hadn't shrunk, and now Antiochus is beginning to get very ambitious, and he goes and he attacks, you know, Ptolemy in Egypt. Now again, this is not the original Ptolemy. The original Ptolemy is the one who lived in Alexander's time. But now, you know, they didn't, you know, Ptolemy the second, third, eighth, you know, that kind of stuff. But the Ptolemites. And Antiochus defeats them. And he doesn't officially take over as king because he doesn't want to cause trouble with the other empires who don't really like this sort of behavior. So he allows Ptolemy to stay king as like a puppet king, but he's basically ruling Egypt. And now he tries to go north into Rome, but he gets repelled and they're telling him, you know, you better stop.
From Egypt he went into Rome.
I'm not sure exactly. I mean, he went through the Mediterranean. Could have gone through Israel, through Syria, through anywhere.
I mean,
not through Syria.
He didn't go through like Turkey or anything.
No, he went through by the sea. Yeah, went by sea. Yeah. And Antiochus was known for being kind of crazy. Right? He was called, they had a lot of names for him, but one of them was like the insane one. He was very hard to predict. He was very reckless. And there began to be some Jews in Israel that wanted to buddy up to him. And the position of political power at the time was the high priest, was the Kohen Gadol. And Antiochus began to help turn the position of Kohen Gadol from a religious position to a political position. Okay? And in fact, he appointed many Kohen Gadols who were not actually Kohens. So, you had many.
Was there a king at the time? Or no?
No, there's no king. The monarchy really ends with the destruction of the first temple. Second temple, there's no kings anymore. So the leadership is kind of haphazard, but the truth is, the Jews weren't independent. Jews were under Persia. Right? They were granted independence, but they were under Persian rule. They basically went from Persian rule to Greek rule, so there was no monarchy, and then from Greek rule to Roman rule. So they didn't really have much time to be independent, except for the Hasmonean period, which we'll get to. That's a time of real independence after the story of Hanukkah. But at this point in history, no, they're under Greek rule, so there's no king.
And the second temple has been built already?
The second temple was built about 500 BC. So the second temple has been around for a long time, right? When Alexander takes over, the temple's been built for about 200 years, okay? It was up for 200 years or so, and that was built by Persia, right?
Yeah.
Who had just recently defeated Babylon, right? So you've had this flow, so for about 300 years, 200, 250, 300 years, Israel's under Persia, and now Greece, and now we're about 300 years into the Second Temple period, even more than that. Okay. So now you begin to get this big civil war. There's a big discussion going on. Not really a discussion, but a lot of different opinions in Israel as to how Greek should we get. Okay? So again, to this point, for the 150 years since Alexander took over Israel, Jews were allowed to be Jews. Right? You weren't given any problems being Jewish. You're under Greek rule, you paid some taxes, that's it. And that hadn't really been messed with. But now, for the first time, Antiochus is beginning to go rogue. Now you've got this guy who's going rogue. And he's already demonstrated some extreme behavior. And he's going to want to take over Israel in a way that it hadn't been taken over before. And some of the leeway that had been given to Israel to not make it more Greek was going to begin to change. Right? Since Alexander, they weren't forced to put up, you know, statues of the Greek gods and do all these things. They weren't forced to build Greek gymnasiums, right? Things that in every Alexandria city, like in Egypt, that's the first thing that they do, is they build these huge edifices as a tribute to Greece. That's what they did when they took over a country. But they hadn't done that to Israel because of this relationship Alexander had with the Jewish people that was respected, and that hadn't happened. But now, Antiochus is saying, you know what, it's time for that to end. So that's why this is happening 150 years after Alexander's death, because it's because of Antiochus that this begins to happen. And it gets worse and worse and worse, and slowly but surely, as these things tend to happen, one law becomes another law becomes another law. They can't keep kosher, they can't learn Torah, circumcision, of course, right? And there's a case... Sorry?
What about the new moon? That's usually.
The Book of Maccabees, which is a very interesting book. The Book of Maccabees is one of the best historical accounts in the story of Hanukkah. It's not part of Tanakh; it's written much later, but it's probably the most accurate account that we have on the story of Hanukkah. It's a very interesting read. So it mentions a number of different things that were taken away. I don't remember the new moon being mentioned. I'm sorry? Most of more than three things. The Book of Maccabees mentions, I think, seven or eight things that the Jews were no longer allowed to do. Circumcision was certainly at the top of the list. And there's a record of two mothers who were found to circumcise their sons. And the mother and the Book of Maccabees says the mother and baby were thrown off a cliff together as punishment, as a lesson to everybody else. So this is getting, you know, now we're getting to a point where we're at serious religious oppression. Okay? Antiochus has had it up to here. He no longer wants this Israel to have any special rules and regulations. And there's a lot of Jews who are agreeing with him. Either they agree with him, or they don't want to fight this trend. And slowly but surely, you're getting built up within Israel a very strong group of people who are buddying up to Antiochus, are buddying up to Greece, and basically think it's time for Israel, for the Jewish people, to stop being so overtly Jewish. It's time to go with the times, it's time to be Greece. And not the last time that the Jewish people have thought that way.
The first reform movement.
It wasn't even a reform movement, it was
assimilation.
Yeah, this is a full-fledged assimilation movement. Okay. And there's some fights breaking out. Okay. So there's a it kind of comes to a head. There's a rumor that spreads that Antiochus was killed in Egypt, and a number of Jews led by the high priest, his name is Jason, right? Again, a Greek name. And a lot of Jews had Greek names. A lot of Jews had Greek names. Even very prominent, very religious Jews had Greek names. So Jason had been the high priest. He'd been the Kohen Gadol, and he was forced out because he didn't fit Antiochus' likings. They think Antiochus is killed, and he gathers 1,000 forces to take over from the current high priest. His name is Menelaus, M-E-N-E-L-A-U-S, Menelaus. And they think that now they're going to take over the country again because Antiochus is dead. Antiochus is not dead. And he finds out that there was a rebellion, and he comes in to crush it. And this is the description in Maccabees. When these happenings were reported to the king, he thought that Judea was in a revolt. Raging like a wild animal, he set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women and children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. So this is what they were dealing with. The second Antiochus gets a sense that Jews are fighting back, and the Jews want to kind of regain their independence, he crushes it. Okay, and now the Jewish people are really have to decide. Are we going to just let this happen, or are we going to fight back? And the beginning of the rebellion happens with a story that becomes pretty well known by Matisyahu. So Matisyahu is asked is asked to witness a sacrifice by a Hellenized Jew of a pig in the temple. And he was already seen as a rebel, seen as somebody who was not really following along with the Greek way, and they wanted to make a demonstration of him that you can witness this, there's nothing you can do about it. And Matisyahu takes out a sword and kills the guy who's slaughtering this pig in the temple.
Kills the Jew. And his two Greek bodyguards.
And what?
And his two Greek bodyguards.
And his two Greek bodyguards. And basically screams out, you know, if you are with God, come with me. And he and his five sons run off into the caves and hide and prepare for war, and then slowly but surely people gather and join them. The Midrash, kind of a obscure Midrash, has a story of a sister of theirs. And they have a sister who's about to get married, and there was a policy in place that when a Jewish girl was going to get married, the Greek officer in charge had rights to her first. Okay, and the story goes in the Midrash that at the day of her wedding, she's preparing for a wedding, the Greek officer comes in. And he's like grabbing her, you know, by her, grabs her out of the house, takes her, and she fights back, and he rips her clothes off, and she screams out to her brothers and to her father, "You're not going to do anything. You're just going to let this happen." So that's another thing Midrash says that kind of what spurred the family to say, "Okay, enough is enough. If we die, we die, but we have to fight." And so they begin to fight, and slowly but surely,
what happened to his sister?
How's the Midrash end? I think they fight. What? No, that's another story. That's Judith.
Yeah. No,
that's
Judith. They kill herself?
No. I think they fight and they take her back. I think that's part of also the That's the Midrash's account of a story like that, that also kind of spurs this along. I believe, I have to double check. No, Yehudit wasn't their sister. No, she wasn't their sister. She was. That's a separate story. Connected, it's kind of unclear exactly even where it happens, but yeah. And so they begin to fight. And they begin to fight with a number of different, you know, they're just kind of picking off soldiers in the beginning, right? They're in hiding, they're ambushing people, and they're slowly but surely taking on, but they're not really taking on any major battles yet, but and there's still this ragtag group of people, but still not much was happening. So Matisyahu dies 1 year after that story happens, just dies natural death. And now the son that takes over is Judah the Maccabee. Maccabee, there's a few different interpretations. Some say Maccabee comes from the Aramaic term for Hamlet. But most also say it stands for Hebrew, it's an acronym. Mi Kamocha. Be'elim Hashem. Who else is like those who are with God? So it's spelled, so this Maccabee, you know, Mem Kaf, but hey, spells out Maccabee. So that's another interpretation of where it comes from. Suppose he had this on his sword, and he was had armor and sword. And Judah the Maccabee, in some ways, I think, becomes the Alexander the Great of the Jewish people. And their stories are interesting. They're kind of similar. Now, Judah wasn't necessarily shunned by his father, but his big break is that his father dies pretty soon after this starts.
No foul play,
but still. And he has this same kind of charisma and same kind of courage that you don't have many people like him in Jewish history. And I always joke that if you're like a, you know, a Jewish high school and you have a basketball team and you're looking for Jewish history, what to name your team, right? You don't have many options, right? What are you going to be? You know, so you're the Maccabees, right? Because who else is, you know, represents the strong, you know? You can't be the Crusaders.
So.
What? The Irgunis. Yeah, I guess that might, yeah, no. In modern times, we have more examples of that. But for much of Jewish history, we don't have many Maccabees. And Judah the Maccabee is really this Jewish figure that almost doesn't seem like a Jewish figure. He is strong, he's courageous, he leads them to battle, and he's able to inspire people to follow him. And he's a tactician, and he, you know, and war after war, battle after battle, they win. And they set off, like I said, picking off small groups, and then they send larger armies and they defeat them, send large armies and defeat them until Antiochus gets involved, and then he sends a large army and they defeat the large army. And so, eventually, Antiochus realizes it's not worth it. So Antiochus, who took over Egypt, who was able to conquer Egypt, can't conquer this rebellion. And he gets to the point where it's not worth it anymore to fight this rebellion. He's going to lose his entire force, and now he's going to lose everything. So they're able to push it back. And that's what the story of Chanukah is about. Is about this, you know, the group of people starting from a small family that was able to lead the Jewish people who were in really in serious threat of extinction, both physically and spiritually. There are many, you know, those who had already assimilated were seen to too far gone to really come back, many of them. And those who were not assimilated, they were constantly in threat of death. So how are they going to survive? How are the Jewish people going to survive? And it was only because they fought back against all odds that they win this war. And Judah the Maccabee, you know, the fact that they had the small army that defeats the big army, and so, you know, that's kind of the... What's interesting is that you have Alexander, who starts off that way with Greece defeating Persia, this small army that shouldn't win, and he just has this sense of divine purpose, and that we're supposed to win this war, and God wants us to win this war, and we're going to fight till the end because this is what we're here to do. That's the message of Judah and Maccabee too. They've got the small army defeating the big army. So I think there's some interesting parallels that I enlist in my own mind of how you start off with Alexander, and Judah the Maccabee becomes the Jews Alexander the Great. And you know, there's an interesting history after this. After they win the war, say about a 100-year period of the Hasmonean dynasty, right? So the Hasmoneans, that's the Second Temple period, the time when Jews have real independence, is during this dynasty, when they really push out Greece. That lasts until the Romans come calling, you know, about a little more than 100 years later. Well, then you're getting into
Thanks
the Roman
to the Maccabees.
What?
Thanks to the Maccabees.
What do you mean?
The brothers had a Macharkis, and one invited the Greeks.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other story. Yeah.
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 When did the Greek War last with the Greeks?
Not very long. It's a couple of years.
No, I think it was
13 or 22. That's what I heard.
What?
13
years, and I heard 22 years.
The war.
Well, Antiochus doesn't live that long. He doesn't survive much longer. The entirety of all the wars being 25 years?
Yes, it was back and forth. I remember reading in art school, sometimes there were internal problems within Greece, and they would leave the Jews alone, and then they would deal with their internal problems, and after a while, they would just do something about these Jews. It was back and forth a lot.
Yeah, I mean, when they won the war, it didn't mean that Greece left them alone, but I think...
It means they probably left them alone.
Well, they left the temple alone.
They had an internal problem, where he was facing a rebellion at home. Antiochus, another king, and so he had to deal with it. So you just leave the.
No, I know, but Antiochus dies.
This is even, I don't think it lasted after that time. I think after.
Yeah, I know, but that's already something different. That's already a. That's a back and forth, but it's not quite the same thing.
Well, when they won, they didn't.
They were
like an autonomous region. They were not independent.
The Maccabees, if he was able to go to the temple and. Because the Greek decided, well, we have our own problems that we have to deal with. We'll deal with the Jews later, if at all.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they fought their independence, but didn't mean that they weren't that Greece wasn't going to come back at some point. And they, no, for sure they did. But
they weren't actually just thrown out. I mean, Greece had its own problems. It's like the British, they had enough and they left.
No, I know. But from the period that they defeated Antiochus's army, they're seen as an independent entity, right? Right. Then they were then a sovereign nation in essence, kind of fighting off the Greeks as opposed to trying to kick them out of their internal.
They at least stayed out of the temple.
Let's see. I'm gonna see if we have any official years here for the. All right, it's not loading up. So yeah, I will just see the exact dates. But yeah, so for sure. All right, any questions?
What about the candles?
Okay, the candles. I didn't bring up the candles. I didn't bring up the candles because the candles are, in the grand scheme of things, not really a significant part of the story, in a funny way, right? The candles are. The candles represent the message from God that the war was divine. That winning the war was divine. That's what the candles are. But the candles themselves aren't the message. The message is that everything that happened to that point was from God. Right? And it's significant because the Second Temple period was not... was seen as the time period after the miracles had ended. Right? Prophecy... The last prophets are at the end of the First Temple period, and there are different miracles that took place in the First Temple that didn't take place in the Second Temple period. The Second Temple was the stepbrother of the First Temple. Right? It was not the same. It was not as glorious. It didn't have the same power. The Ark wasn't there anymore. So it was seen as a time period where open miracles had stopped. Prophecy and open miracles had stopped. And... What makes Chanukah so that the reason that the story of the candles is significant is because it's taking place at a time where miracles are supposed to not be happening anymore. Right? We don't have any more splitting seas. We don't have any more 10 plagues, and yet it happened in this story. So it was showing the divine nature of this entire story, the divine protection that the Maccabees had been given, and it showed that even in a time period when it seems like miracles don't exist, they still do. Right? And so that's what Hanukkah represents in many ways. The story of Hanukkah is the story of the of this battle, of these wars, of fighting for independence. But we cling to the menorah because it represents that God was there the entire time. And then just because you don't see the miracles doesn't mean they're not there. And so I think that's why this this becomes part a big part of it. It also justifies why we have a holiday, right? Because we've had many different things happen to us that were good, but we don't give them holidays, and we don't give them this kind of significance. The story of Purim at least takes place in a time when there's still some sort of prophecy, right? We look at Esther as a prophet, we look at Mordecai as a prophet. So, Esther as a prophetess. So, these things still exist. And so Hanukkah is the holiday of the post-biblical era. It's the holiday that represents that era. It also represents Jews, you know, being under non-Jewish rule and surviving situations that we're going to encounter over and over again. Purim does that too. You know, the two holidays we have after the fact, you know, I mean, after the Torah is given, are Purim and Hanukkah, and they both are about how to survive in a non-Jewish world, especially a non-Jewish world that gets increasingly hostile towards you. And they're very different stories. You know, Purim is a story where there's no battle. Eventually there's some sort of battle, but there's kind of this internal plan, and then Hanukkah is more, you know, a story of a war. But so they represent kind of two different kinds of episodes that can happen in our future. Yeah?
I learned that really Hanukkah is a story of miracles. That there were hidden miracles and there were open miracles. The oil lasting for 8 days was an open miracle.
Right.
The Maccabees winning against, you know, the ruler, the Greek ruler,
right.
That was a hidden miracle because it made no sense that they could win, you know, these battles.
Right, for sure. But again, you know, Alexander the Great had just done the same thing. And so I think what
he didn't do it with yeshiva kids.
He did it with
trained army.
Right. You want me to fight a war? All right.
Which end was sticking with?
What? You want us to fight a war?
Not today.
You fought with yeshiva kids.
I'll fight by you. What?
But Kofa fought with yeshiva kids.
Yeah, Bar Kokhba also did it.
Yeah,
right, but no, you're right. But you're right. I think the point is that the open miracle of the oil makes clear the hidden miracle of the Maccabees.
And what I learned was they didn't make it a holiday until another year had gone by, and they could perceive the spiritual energy around that time of year.
Okay, I'm not sure spiritual energy that time of year is, I'm not sure exactly what that means.
That it was the elevated spiritual energy of a holiday. I don't know how to do it, but that's what
yeah,
I
okay.
I heard that on Shalom TV just today.
Shalom TV?
Yeah, Baba Mordechai Becher did this year.
Oh, yeah?